takes me 2 or 3 days to kind of get over it. Good morning. How are you?
Welcome back. When did you get back?
I got back Friday afternoon, so. Yeah, good to be on. Yeah. Good to be on this side of the planet.
Seems like a short trip.
Yeah, it was. About less than a week. Yeah.
Yes. The prodigal preacher and the prodigal elder. And I told him, I said, no fruit were launched at the stage, so that's at least a moderate success.
Yeah.
Good morning. I was in Germany on Friday. Of course, it was only this little tiny section on the left side of Epcot, but Epcot at Disney World, they have a world showcase where it's all manned by citizens from those countries that are here on work visas. All right, I'm just opening mine and then minimize it. And then it's all yours. Are you using it this morning, Ken?
Yes.
Okay. Then I will just minimize.
My favorite one is Wenn der Hahn kräht auf dem Mist, in der Tisch ist, wenn der Hund ist, bleibt die Sest. Rooster crows on top of the mirror pile. The weather will either change or we're going to stay the same.
You know, German wisdom goes beyond
bounds. Do you ever read that Babylon Bee blog? Some people put out, I don't know who does it, but it's pretty conservative religiously, because their most common person they hammer is Joel Osteen.
Oh, goodness.
And they, I mean, it just comes out with little articles like, yeah. Joel Osteen apologizes because he used the word Jesus in a sermon. Stuff like that all the time. Well, this last one said, Joel Osteen sees his own shadow. We should get at least another, I think it says another 6 weeks of misapplied scripture. That was the headline. I thought,
okay.
I don't know who puts it out. They,
somebody's,
they hammer on Osteen quite a bit.
Yeah.
One time Mary and I were headed for the Brownfields mid-afternoon. It was raining. And we actually saw a triple rainbow.
Really?
Yep.
Nice.
Never before, it makes sense.
Yeah, I've seen a duel with a little piece of a third, but I've never seen a full triple, so. Oh, yeah, 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 it's, they're pretty cool. Where's my folder? It is, it really is. It's pretty amazing the way it can just come and go so quickly. All right. Well, let's see. On one of the halls, I was in one of those Airbus A380s, which is a double-decker boatload of seats. I don't know how many people that plane will seat, but it's the biggest thing I've ever been on. And, yeah, pretty close. And then the other one was, yeah, that was the first time I'd been in one. And then there was a Boeing Dreamliner that was pretty cool. What's that? So 787, yeah, yeah.
How does it feel running down the runway?
You know, it's very smooth. Both those planes, as for as large as they were, kind of like a lumbering ox, you know, they just sort of rumble down, and you don't think they're going fast enough by the time they start lifting off. So I don't know what kind of lift speed they've got. They work fine and stay here. Yeah, yeah. One would think so. Let's see here. Better swap out the battery. Just a minute or two, but about time to start. I think the appropriate greeting for today is g'day. And that kind of encompasses not knowing what time of day your body's in. It's about 1:30 in the morning in Adelaide, Australia, this right now. So we'll be working through that. 1:30 a.m. tomorrow. Yeah, it's always fun when you fly from here, you leave on Friday, and you arrive on Sunday late afternoon. And then when you start out Friday morning. It was 4 o'clock when I got out of bed, and I traveled for over 30 hours and got here Friday afternoon. Somehow that doesn't work right. You don't get those days back. It's just different. If you have your Bible, we might be turning to 1 Kings and also to 2 Chronicles. We're going to be looking this morning primarily at Jehoshaphat. Benjamin last week kind of took a look at the last couple of the events that we had in the life of Ahab, who was the king up in the north in Israel, and then his companion, ruler down in the south during most of his reign, was Jehoshaphat, the son of Asa. So we're going to be looking primarily at Jehoshaphat this morning, but we've got one little wrap-up to do on Ahab before we get started. Jehoshaphat's a very interesting king. I kind of consider him to be the one who had a hard time figuring out which side of the line he was going to walk on. A lot of good things said about him, but a lot of really silly things that he did. So we'll be looking at those this morning as we can. Before we start, I'm going to ask Drew if he would to lead us in a word of prayer, please. All right. One of the things to keep in mind here is that we're looking at this kind of time period right after 850. This particular spot right here is 853, and we're going to be talking about that in just a minute. This little guy on the right, and I'll show you another one that's very similar to this, is a guy named spell it any way you want to. It's not in English anyway, so they're just phonetically putting it together. Ashur-Nisirapol. Who was the father of the next guy, Shalmaneser, which you only see a little bit of his name there, both of which were the Assyrian kings during this time period. Now, the reason that's important is that Assyria is beginning to rise in its dominance of the world during this time period. They'd been kind of a hodgepodge of little kings and things for a while, but they're beginning to consolidate. And so as we look at the territory again of Israel being in this area, you always have to kind of watch out and not get too confused here, because there's Syria up here, which is also called Aram, and Assyria is like way over here someplace on the map, up across around the Euphrates River. So those kings from Assyria are beginning to extend their influence further to the west as they're moving in that direction, and we're going to see that impact today as we look at Jehoshaphat. So as we look at Ahab, and looked at the things that are written in 1 Kings having the record of both the northern and southern kings, we find that the real thing that he was called down for was introducing Baal worship. That at the time before him, they had the cattle that were in Dan and Bethel at the two extents of Israel, but that had been kind of just a
perversion of Jehovah worship. They were still saying, behold, the gods that brought you out of Egypt, as Jeroboam set those things up. But now we have Ahab marrying Jezebel, who is from Sidon and in the Phoenician area, and bringing in this worship of these idols, these gods of the lands around them. So now they're beginning to get to a point where they're leaving Jehovah God, the God that brought them out of Egypt, really, further and further behind. So when we look at all of the interaction between Ahab and Elijah, primarily during this time frame, not a good relationship there. But as you look at Elijah, he spent his time in the north trying to warn the people, warn them about what was going on. And last week, Benjamin covered both that war with Ben-Hadad, where Ahab was granted a boon by God of a victory and then squandered it by releasing the very one that God had said he was to destroy. So from that instance, and then after he hijacked Naboth's vineyard, Elijah came and basically predicted his demise and said that his line was going to be wiped out. And then he turns around and humbles himself before God just enough that God relents and says, well, I won't bring it about in his days, but it will come about in the days of his son. So the last battle, and I want to start here just kind of as the death, and then we're going to go back and cover the battle in a minute. But look over in 1 Kings, the 22nd chapter, as it gives kind of the wrap-up of Ahab. There we go. I'll get the right name here in a second. And let's primarily look at beginning verse 41. Am I in the right chapter here? Hang on 2 seconds. Yes. That's Jehoshaphat. Now I was going to start with Ahab. All right. I'm sorry, I got the wrong thing here. We've got to go back a little bit. Yes, there we go. Okay, back in 22nd chapter, and beginning in verse 35, as they look at that battle for that day, it says that the battle raged that day, and the king was propped up in his chariot in front of the Arameans, and he died at the evening. And the blood from the wound ran into the bottom of the chariot. And then a cry passed throughout the army close to sunset, saying, every man to his city and every man to his country. And so the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria. And they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. Now the harlots bathed themselves there, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke. And now the rest of the acts of Ahab and all that he did, and the ivory house which he built, and all the cities which he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And so Ahab slept with his fathers, and Ahaziah his son became king in his place. Now, did any of that kind of ring a bell as to what Elijah had talked to Ahab about when he sees the vineyard? How did he say he was going to die? What was going to be happening there? Yeah, the dogs would lick up his blood. Now, what's this whole point about the dogs licking up his blood and then that's where the harlots bathe and all this kind of stuff? Why is that? I mean, it's lots of nice detail, I guess. But why is that there? What's it really say? Exactly. There was no honor in his death, and he was not really honored. He had pulled Israel just way out. And so we're going to see later on that continues when his son is kind of pulled down, that he is also going to die in the way that was predicted by Elijah. So this is a second one, and this one looks a lot like the other one, but it's not. This one is a parallel one. There were two of them that were found together, and this is of the son Shalmaneser III. It's also in the British Museum. And this is the king that was part of the attack during the Battle of Karkar where Ahab was killed. And one of the interesting things is if you look at the inscription, this was the first time that Ahab was actually named on that inscription. Yes? You can't see it. Yeah, you can't, can you? You'd have to turn the lights out to see it because it's kind of dim there. It's also, the other one is, that'll teach me to do animation. It takes too long to go back. This one is a lot cleaner, even though it's the older one. And one of the ways you can tell the difference is the way these symbols are aligned. And then you get to this other one, and they're aligned differently, but it's really hard to see because they're almost kind of smudged off. Sorry about that. If you want to kill the lights for just a second, there, David, right behind you, just so you can get a look at these guys. Father and son. Is that any better? You can barely see his outline here. And that other symbol that I was showing that was in line here is actually over here a little bit. You can kind of see his arm, and he's still holding the rod. They're taking the same pose, father and son kind of thing. But the main thing is we kind of know when this battle occurred because we've got a lot of records from Assyria about when that happened. And here we have Ahab, and it says with 12 other kings that were involved in that battle where the Assyrians came down. And effectively, if you read the rest of the inscription, it's kind of interesting because he talks about how many fields he littered with the bodies of his enemies. You know, it's very dramatic there. Okay, bring the lights on there again. All right, so let's take a look at Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat is a contemporary with Ahab. While all of this is going on in the north that we've been studying over the last couple of weeks, the king in the south is Jehoshaphat. Take a look, and we're going to start with 1 Kings, the 22nd chapter, verses 41 through 44. It says, "Now Jehoshaphat, the son of Asa, became king over Judah in the fourth year of Ahab, the king of Israel. Jehoshaphat was 35 years old when he became king, and he reigned for 25 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Azubah, the daughter of Shili. And he walked in all the ways of Asa, his father. He did not turn aside from it, doing right in the sight of the Lord. However, the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places. Jehoshaphat also made peace with the king of Israel." Now, we're going to pick up our look at over in 2 Chronicles. So if you want to turn over there, we're going to be looking at 2 Chronicles 17 in just a moment. But this is just a little summary of Jehoshaphat. He reigned for 25 years, and it says in Kings, it says 24 years in Chronicles. One of the reasons you get some differences in these number of years of reign is that it depends on how you count it. The ascension year is counted by some people, and it's not by others. So a lot of times you'll get this one-off difference between them. But when you look at what it says there in Kings, it calls out that the high places were not taken away. But we're going to find out over in Chronicles that it talks about he did take away some of the high places. What you really are looking at here in terms of his life is a lot of a little bit back and forth that we're going to have to see and figure out how he fits in with what he was trying to do. Because it says that he followed in the ways of his father Asa. And in 2 Chronicles, it's going to say that he followed in the paths of David. And so that's always a good sign, right? When you get somebody who's saying that they followed in the paths of David. Okay, now we understand that one. That one's good. But this high place is not taken away, and the hearts of the people were not turned. So as we go through a couple of things in his life, I want you to take a look at someone who was struggling to do what was right, and I think had good intentions, but sometimes made bad decisions, even though they had good intentions. So one of the first things that I want to look at is 2 Chronicles 17, 1 through 9, because the Chronicles are talking about the kings of Judah primarily. And one of the things that it emphasizes is when those kings were doing what was right and when those kings were doing what was wrong. And this is a piece that we don't often associate with Jehoshaphat. There's a battle we're going to get to in a little bit, and that's a little bit more famous in terms of the things that Jehoshaphat did. But beginning in chapter 17, verse 1, it says, "Jehoshaphat his son then became king in his place, and he made his position firm over Israel. And he placed troops in all the fortified cities of Judah and set garrisons in the land of Judah and in the cities of Ephraim, which Asa his father had captured. And the Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he followed the example of his father David's earlier days and did not seek the Baals. But he sought the God of his father, followed his commandments, and did not act as Israel did. So the Lord established his kingdom in his control. And all Judah brought tribute to Jehoshaphat, and he had great riches and honor. And he took great pride in the ways of the Lord, and again removed the high places and the Asherim from Judah. Then in the third year of his reign, he sent officials. And then it lists a bunch of the officials in verse 7. And then verse 8, it says, and with them the Levites, and then it names a bunch of Levites, and then with them the priests. So he's got officials and Levites and priests. They taught in Judah, having the book of the law of the Lord with them. And they went throughout all the cities of Judah and taught among the people. The very first sort of big act that it lists, when you look at the front end of it, is he fortified things. Okay? That makes sense, right? King fortifying. But normally, kings then want, and after they've got their military fortifications in place, they want to make sure that whatever their laws and things are distributed among the people. People need to know what the king expects. But when Jehoshaphat got his folks together to go teach the people what the king expected, who's he send? Priests and Levites, as well as the officials. Now, you notice it said the officials first, so that they know that this is what the king wants. This is his demand. But then the ones that are doing the teaching are the priests and Levites. And how? What are they teaching from? The book of the law. What would that be, primarily? The Torah. The first five books. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. The books of the law. Now, they may have had some of the other writings and things with them, but not much by this point. And they said they carried that with them. Why would they have to carry it with them? I mean, every town, they're just going to go pick one up at the local bookstore, right? Now, these were massive scrolls, right? I mean, they're probably pretty heavy. If you get all five books, you're going to have something probably more than one person could carry even. And they were precious. They were valuable. Now, I find it interesting that they're still around. They have them. In this time since David, they haven't yet lost it all, which we're going to find later in the history. They wound up having to rediscover them. So they still have them, and they understand their value. And he sends out the Levites, in a lot of ways, to do their job, right? What was it the Levites were supposed to be doing? But teaching the people the law. And I like that about Jehoshaphat, that that's basically the second thing when it comes after the fortification and establishing the military strength. Next thing he wants to do is get the people on board. Now, it says that he did start tearing down the high places. Then we found over in 2 Kings it says they weren't all torn down. How do you reconcile that? Okay, there's part of it is maybe the work was never completed. Part of it is when he tore them down, if the hearts of the people were not turned, which is one of the things that it says, what are they going to do after the officials and the Levites leave? Put it back up, right? So I think this is an ongoing process. This isn't just a matter of one shot, you tear them all down, you're done. Okay? This is a matter of changing the hearts of the people. And Jehoshaphat was trying, but he didn't succeed in changing all the hearts of the people. There's another good lesson in that as you start looking at it. We try, right, when we teach. What's our job as the priests of God in this world? But to teach, right, and to help to try to change the hearts of the people. And sometimes it's discouraging when you teach or you talk or you live right, and it seems like nobody pays any attention. Well, you know, it's kind of always been like that. Even during this time where the ruler was trying to do what was right. And I don't know, to me that's always just interesting comparison of the balance. Because if you get a ruler who really doesn't want to do what's right, like Jehu or like Jeroboam, and he sets these things up, what happens with a lot of the people? A lot of the people go, cool, that's what I wanted to do anyway, right? And so now it's all licensed and we can go. So you get a bad ruler at the top and things can get really worse. And then you get a good ruler at the top, like David. But was the kingdom fully turned to God during David's time either? No. Or here we have Jehoshaphat who's trying. Was it fully turned to God? No. Well, they can fix things a little bit, but they never fix them completely. And that's an interesting lesson as you look at how times haven't changed all that much in terms of the way people react. So he taught the people the book of the law. But now the other thing it said, just a one-liner over in 1 Kings, was that he made peace with Israel. Well, Now we find out how he made peace with Israel. If you look on down in chapter 18, it says, Jehoshaphat had great riches and honor, and he allied himself by marriage with Ahab. Basically, his son married Ahab's daughter. Now, that's where you start scratching your head and start trying to figure out, why in the world would this man do that? Did he not know who Ahab was and the problems they were having in Israel to his north? I'm sure he did. What's he thinking? What's he thinking? In Romans, there's an interesting chapter, chapter 11 and 12, where it starts talking about personal responsibility and things. And one of the things towards the end of chapter 12 is it says, as far as is possible, we are to be at peace with all men, as much as it relies on you. I think he's trying to be at peace. It says he wanted to make peace with Israel. He might be concerned for his people. He doesn't want to have a war with Israel and against them. What's one of the common ways that people allied back then? Well, they got aligned by some sort of marriage. So I think he's trying to make peace with Israel. But he's doing it in a way that's going to cause a lot of problems in a very short period of time. So he allies himself with Ahab by getting their kids married. But then, some years later, we have this battle that they're going to go into, which is going to be the downfall of Ahab. But they go together, and Ahab, the king of Israel, says to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, "Will you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead?" And he said to him, "I am as you are, my people as your people, and we will be with you in the battle." Now, Ramoth-Gilead is over in this area. This map didn't have Samaria on it, but it's about right there. And Ramoth-Gilead had been taken by the Aramaeans. So it's still under Aramaean control. And Ahab wants his city back. What he doesn't bank on is that this is going to be a really big battle, because the Aramaeans are winding up being tangled up with the Assyrians. So we got the Syrians and the Assyrians. Plus, there's a whole bunch of other kings in the area that are going to get involved in this. And he's going to suck Judah into it as well. So he's trying to get it muster as much as he can in this coming battle. And he says, "You need to go with me." Now, we won't read through all of this. I'm hoping that this is a story that's relatively familiar to you as they are trying to figure out how to go to war. And, of course, Ahab calls in all of his prophets, and he says, "Should I go or not?" What do all his prophets say? Hoorah! You know, we're ready to roll. Everything's going to go. And Jehoshaphat's watching these guys kind of cavort before him. And he goes, "Don't you still have a prophet that's from God somewhere around here?" He goes, "Yeah, I got one. There's this guy, Micaiah. I don't like him at all." Why did Ahab not like Micaiah? He never says anything good. Which just goes to show you, right, how people are with relationship to their boss a lot of times, right? These prophets knew where their bread was buttered, and so they're always saying something good. So he brings in Micaiah, and when he first comes in, of course, the guard that's dragging him in says, "Now, look, everybody else is in favor of this thing, so you need to be in favor of it too." And, of course, Micaiah basically says, "You know, I'll say what God tells me to say." So they get up there, and he says, "Are we supposed to go?" And he goes, "Sure, go ahead. Why not?" No. Tell me the truth. Well, his truth kind of stung, because when it got time to tell him the truth, verse 15 of chapter 18, he says, "The king said to him, 'How many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?' And so he said, 'I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep which have no shepherd. And the Lord said, These have no master. Let each of them return to his house in peace.' And then the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, 'Did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil?'" It's like, "I told you so." Well, even after hearing this, Jehoshaphat decides to go up. And they all were going to go to war. And not only does he decide to go, look over beginning in verse 28. He says, "The king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went up against Ramoth-Gilead. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, 'I will disguise myself and go into battle.' but you put on your robes. And so the king of Israel disguised himself, and they went into battle. Now the king of Aram had commanded the captains of his chariot, saying, do not fight with the small or the great, but with the king of Israel alone. And so when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat, they said, it's the king of Israel. And they turned aside and to fight against him. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him, and God diverted them from him. And when the captains of the chariot saw that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. And a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel in a joint of the armor. And so he said to the driver of the chariot, turn around and take me out of the fight, for I am severely wounded. And the battle raged that day, and the king of Israel propped himself up in his chariot in front of the Arameans until the evening, and then at sunset he died. Now, in addition to going up against the wishes of Micaiah, he agreed to this really just bizarre scheme of being the target. I don't know if you've read much. I don't read a lot about it, but I know some of you have read about various battles in either the Civil War or World War II and things like that. Especially in World War II, when there was tank battles, you know how the U.S. was really successful? One of the things they did was there's a whole bunch of tanks out there. One of them had this big giant antenna on it with a flag. Who's in there? That's the guy commanding the rest of them, right? So how well are they all going to function if the commander's gone? What's the first tank you want to take out? The guy with the commander, right? How well is the army going to function when their leader is shot down? Not well. It kind of sort of takes the fun out of the fight, right? Puts things in disarray. So it's really a game of capture the flag. I mean, that's kind of one way to look at it, right? They've each got leaders on their sides. They're somehow visible. And I'm not sure if he convinced him saying, look, if I disguise myself, then I'll be able to lead the people. They'll kind of know who I am. We'll be able to kind of do these side maneuvers, and they won't realize what's hit them until I get over there because I'll be the one there. You gotta be the guy on the hill, kind of distract them. Could have been a nice battle plan. Still sounds like suicide to me, but maybe they had some reason for their battle plan. Of course, it doesn't work out. They find out that it's not really Ahab. Of course, they can't tell at a distance. You know, this is before binoculars, folks, okay? So they're all just out there eyeballing it. And whoever their best eagle eye is trying to figure out who it is on the other side of the hill. And then the chariots all go at it, and it's a giant battle. And if the stela that we were looking at is any indication of that, there were a lot of people on the field and a lot of people that died. One of the things he says is the valley wasn't big enough to bury all the bodies that were killed that day. So in that fray, some random guy with a bow shoots an arrow. You ever seen the pictures of the, you know, when they do the hail of arrows, right? They're not really aiming. They just get 10,000 arrows in the air all at once, and they go arcing over, and they're going to hit somebody somewhere, right? Now, if they're smart, like the Romans were, you do the shield thing where you put all the shields up, and you see them in the movies where all the arrows just stick in the shields, right? Nobody gets hurt, and they just, off they go. You know, knock those things off, and you're good. Well, one of those kinds of things, except that this one got a chink in the armor. Now, what are the odds of that happening? There was an arrow that went exactly where God wanted it to go, right? And Ahab pulls out of the battle, lasts until sunset, kind of propped up, but then he dies. And at that point, everybody realizes this is not going well, and off they scatter. That was the end of Ahab, and Jehoshaphat should have learned a lesson there. But it turns out, it took somebody to come and tell him that he needed to learn a lesson. It says, Jehoshaphat, the king of Israel, returned in safety to his house in Jerusalem, and Jehu, the son of Hanani the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord and so bring wrath on yourself from the Lord? But there is some good in you, for you have removed the Asherah from the land and you have set your heart to seek God. And so Jehoshaphat lived in Jerusalem and went out again among the people from Beersheba to the hill country of Ephraim and brought them back to the Lord, the God of their fathers. I take it from that he learned some sort of lesson. The damage is already done as far as the marriage alliance is concerned. But Ahab has now died. It's towards then the end of the reign. If you remember that timeline, they were pretty much co-regents in terms of time. But of course, Jehoshaphat is a little longer past Ahab because Ahab just got killed. But when you start looking at what does he do then with the rest of his life, and he says, okay, I got to redo this. The first time, we went out and we talked to people, trying to bring them back to God. Now he takes a slightly different approach. And I love this piece in terms of his second reform that he initiates. Notice how he does it. Verse 5, it says, he appointed judges in the land, in all the fortified cities of Judah, city by city. And he said to the judges, consider what you are doing. For you do not judge for man, but for the Lord who is with you when you render judgment. Now then, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Be very careful what you do, for the Lord our God will have no part in unrighteousness or partiality or the taking of a bribe. In Jerusalem also, Jehoshaphat appointed some of the Levites and priests and some of the heads of the fathers' households of Israel for the judgment of the Lord and to judge disputes among the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And then he charged them, saying, thus you shall do in the fear of the Lord, faithfully and wholeheartedly. And whenever any dispute comes to you from your brethren who live in their cities, between blood and blood, between law and commandment, statutes and ordinances, you shall warn them so that they may not be guilty before the Lord, and wrath may not come on you and your brethren. Thus you shall do, and you will not be guilty. Now, when you look at that sequence there, he goes out in the land, and he gets the judges there. That's the first part of the judicial system. They have a complaint, they come to those judges. Some of them were the elders in the land, the elders of Israel that would sit in the gate. And so he is admonishing them that they need to be careful in this judgment. Don't you love the words that he says there? Be careful what you're doing, because you are judging people before the Lord. You got to be fair. You got to render it truthfully. And none of this bribe stuff, because that was a way that was, you know, that's one of the time-honored traditions of how to get your way, right? You pay people off. No. Don't want any of that. And then when it says he went to Jerusalem, I get there, that's almost the appellate court. They would have handled maybe the cases from Jerusalem, but a little bit later he says, and when you get cases from the cities that come to you. So if they couldn't reach a judgment there in the city, they would come to Jerusalem. And he had those people with the same admonition. Be careful what you do. You are sitting in a judgment seat. You have to be careful how you judge. So in the first time, he was trying to teach the people, and now he's working on those who are going to be settling disputes and things like that, and trying to, again, instill this fear and reverence of God among everyone. Now, when you look at those two things, by themselves, that would have been a great legacy for a kingship like Jehoshaphat, a great legacy. But he had these in-between things. And so the war with the alliance with Ahab, and then that war that wasn't sanctioned, been a problem there. But once he's turned his heart back to God, it turns out there's another battle that Judah gets invaded again. And in fact, now the army is so large that the people are looking at it thinking, there's no way we can fight this battle. But just like we see in some of the other kings and some of the other times, Jehoshaphat turns to the Lord. It came about in chapter 20 that after this, the sons of Moab and the sons of Ammon, together with some of the Meunites, and that's probably the sons of Edom, if you look further in the chapter, so it's the Edomites, came to make war against Jehoshaphat. Then some came and reported to Jehoshaphat, saying, a great multitude is coming against you from beyond the sea, out of Aram. And behold, they are in Hazon Tamar, that is in Gedi. Jehoshaphat was afraid and turned his attention to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. And so Judah gathered together to seek help from the Lord. They even came from all the cities of Judah to seek the Lord. So you get the impression that this army is gathering. There is some time left. These armies didn't move all that fast when they're that large and having to live off the land and march and that kind of thing. So he's got a little bit of time, but not a lot. And they're pulling these people together, and they don't keep a big standing army. Where does the army come from in most of these kingships back then? If it was time to go to war, what'd you do? Yeah, you went out and you grabbed all the farmers and whoever, and they were your soldiers. Each town would have a levy placed against them. You got to supply X many men because of the size of your village. And it would take time to round all those people up, but you kind of knew how many people you would get. The standing army was small. It was kind of the king's guard. And then there would have been soldiers who were like the sergeants responsible for all of these others, and they kind of knew who the tally was. But they didn't go through a lot of training and stuff. It was all just getting together at the last minute. Well, there's hardly even time to gather the army here before they're going to have to face a far superior force. And so they did what Jehoshaphat wanted them to do, which was turn and seek the Lord. Now, for a lot of people, maybe this is, what do we call it, foxhole religion? You're in a foxhole, you're in a pinch, there's really nothing left, and you realize you're going to be doomed, and so what do? Well, we may as well ask God for help. That's the last thing on the mind. But you don't get that impression from Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, that was the first thing he did, was turn to God at this point. And so they begin to entreat God. Jehoshaphat stands in the assembly and prays. It says that he said, O Lord, the God of our fathers, are you not the God in the heavens? And are you not the ruler over all the kingdoms of the nations? Power and might are in your hand so that no one can stand against you. Did you not, O God, drive out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and give it to the descendants of Abraham, your friend forever? They have lived in it and have built you a sanctuary there for your name, saying, should evil come upon us, the sword or judgment or pestilence or famine, we will stand before this house and before you, for your name is in this house, and cry to you in our distress, and you will hear and deliver us. Now behold, the sons of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom you did not let Israel invade when they came out of the land of Egypt, they turned aside from them and did not destroy them. See how they are rewarding us by coming to drive us out of from your possession, which you have given us as an inheritance. O our God, will you not judge them? For we are powerless before this great multitude who are coming against us, nor do we know what to do, but our eyes are on you. There's a lot of interesting things about that prayer. For starters, did Jehoshaphat know his history pretty well? Yeah. So what that means is that he's not ignorant of those five books of Moses himself, is he? He understood the law, but he also understood their history and knew where they had come from and their background. And he said, now we've built this house. And do you remember even when Solomon dedicated the temple? One of the things that Solomon said is, when there come times of crisis, what should the people do? But gather there and appeal to their God, because his name was written there. And so that's what the people are doing. They're gathering there. And this prayer is just an echo of many of the things that were before. And entreating God as God had said they should entreat him. You can, if you read it the wrong way, you kind of read it like, you know what? You told us we couldn't attack those people way back then, and look where it's gotten us, you know? But that's not really the point. The point is, he says, we showed mercy to them, and look how they're repaying us. Please, God, judge them. So the request is for judgment. This is almost the same, is it not, as some of the imprecable Psalms. Did I get that right? Imprecatory. I'm not sure where that other word came from, but we'll blame it on time lag there, yes. But isn't that the same kind of concept where, you know, instead of wishing good for everyone, they're looking at their enemies and saying, Lord, we need judgment on these people. But they are putting it in the hands of God because they realize they can't be the ones on their own to exercise this kind of judgment. So they pray that prayer there, and then what happens is they get an answer. In the midst of the assembly, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jehaziel, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benaiah, the son of Jael, the son of Mataniah, the Levites of the sons of Asaph. Now, I like that one because who are the sons of Asaph? They're the singers, okay? So here's someone who's probably in the, call it the Levite chorus, right? The ones trained to sing. And he steps forth, and I don't know if he sung this or not, but he at least has a message for the people, and they would have been someone who was a Levite who would have been recognized as someone that this would have been viable for God to speak through them. And he basically says, listen, all Judah and the inhabitants of Judah and the king of Jehoshaphat. Thus says the Lord to you, do not fear or be dismayed because of this great multitude. For the battle is not yours, but God's. Tomorrow, go down against them. Behold, they will come up by the ascent of Ziz, and you will find them at the end of the valley in front of the wilderness of Jeruel. And you need not fight in this battle. Station yourselves and stand and see the salvation of the Lord on your behalf, O Judah and Jerusalem. Do not fear or be dismayed. Tomorrow go out to face them, for the Lord is with you. And Jehoshaphat bowed his head with his face to the ground, and all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem fell down before the Lord, worshiping the Lord. And the Levites from the sons of the Kohathites and of the Korahites stood up to praise the Lord God of Israel with a very loud voice. So their prayer is answered almost immediately, and they said, this battle's not yours, it's God's. Get ready and go out. Now, I want to ask you a question. He says, you don't have to fight tomorrow, but I want you to get ready and to go down and face them. Did they or did they not put their armor on? I think they did. He says they got ready for battle, right? So just because they're putting their faith and trust in God doesn't mean they don't have to do anything. They still had a responsibility to be ready for whatever the Lord needed them to do when they got there to that battle. And part of that is this is going to be a battle. We got to get dressed up for the battle. Why do I bring that up? A lot of times we want to put our faith and trust in God, but that doesn't mean that we don't have a responsibility to prepare for things. Jehoshaphat's army had to be prepared. And so they got themselves ready, and they went out. Now, it turns out that when they got there, they'd started fighting against each other. We had the Syrians, and we had the people from Edom, and the ones from Moab. So that's kind of all around that side of the, all around this side. So we had Edom down here, and Moab up here, and Ammon up here. And they're coming up, it says, from this area. So they're kind of coming up through this attack approach. And the first thing that happens is that the Moabites and the Ammonites somehow get tangled up with those from Edom, and they kill all them out. And then they can't tell themselves apart, and so they wind up fighting each other, not realizing they're fighting the wrong ones. So this whole battle just turns into a mess. And by the time the Israelites get there, it's over. The armies have killed each other. Maybe a little bit of cleanup, but then it says they just went in and gathered the spoil and picked up everything that was of use and of value. And it took them several days to do that because this was a pretty big army. They brought it all back to Jerusalem. Now, once again, we see that Jehoshaphat's faith put in the right place accomplished great things. But you wind up with this final little piece on him, which is why I say sometimes it was hard for him to always walk the line properly. Take a look over in the 20th chapter beginning in verse 31. It says, Jehoshaphat reigned over Judah. He was 35 years old and he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 25 years. And his mother's name was Azubah, the daughter of Shilhi. And he walked in the way of his father Asa and did not depart from it, doing right in the sight of the Lord. The high places, however, were not removed. The people had not yet directed their hearts to the God of their fathers. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoshaphat, first to last, behold, they are written in the annals of Jehu, the sons of Hanai, which is recorded in the book of the kings of Israel. And after this, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, allied himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel. And he acted wickedly in so doing. And so he allied himself with him to make ships to go to Tarshish, and they made the ships in Ezion-Geber. And then Eliezer, the son of Dodiah of Mereshah, the prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, because you have allied yourself with Ahaziah, the Lord has destroyed your works. And so the ships were broken and could not go to Tarshish. So almost about the time you think he's learned a lesson, if we go back and look at that timeline, Ahaziah only had a very, very short reign, and we'll get into that next week. So during that time period, Jehoshaphat, who's not quite learned his lesson, decides to have an economic alliance this time. And they had a joint endeavor to build some ships to go down, probably do some trading along the coastlines, all the way down to Tarshish, the tail end where you look at the end of the Mediterranean. A big sort of, at that day and age, gamble, you know, on going to make a lot of money doing this. He says, no, you should not have made this alliance with them. And so all the ships were wrecked. And they never came home. That's kind of with two great things in there, actually three great things, including the battle for Jehoshaphat. It's kind of sad that you get that one as the closing piece to say that they're towards the end. He still hadn't quite gotten it in terms of his alliance with Israel. So I think there's a lot of lessons there. He put his faith and trust in God. He was trying to do what was right. He sent the teachers out. He reformed the judicial system. He put his faith in God when it came time to fight this battle. But he wanted peace with Israel. He didn't want to fight that. And I'm sure he had good intentions in doing that. But he did not understand that sometimes the price of peace is too high. And God did not want him to make those alliances, even though they might have looked good at the time. So I think there's some lessons there that we can take away as we start looking at how we live. We may not be kings. We may not have the same kind of alliances. But we always have to make these decisions in our life of what we're going to do, how we're going to live, who are the people that we're going to be best friends with. And in all of those things, let's keep in mind what God wants us to do and not necessarily what we think might be right at the time. Any questions before we close this morning? Thank you.